It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, the cook and the book. So there are two things we learn to do with our mouths when we're really small: taste and talk. Almost before we can walk, we discover that both words and food are delicious, and that both tell stories.
I have a very specific memory of when my husband and I were first living together, and there was one night on like a rainy October when we both got called off work and stayed home and roasted a chicken with lemons in it. To this day, as soon as it gets to be kind of cool outside again, I'm like, I want to roast that chicken with lemons. And I can still see like the darkness outside. I can see the warm light in my kitchen. It says, you know, 20 years of romance in a way to me that just a roast chicken shouldn't say.
Today we're talking about the language of food with chefs who write and novelists who cook, beginning with Michelle Wilgin, a novelist and executive editor at Tin House Literary Magazine. She lives here in Madison, and she's just written a novel called Bread and Butter, a hilarious peek at the inside workings of restaurant kitchens, told through the eyes of three brothers with rival restaurants. Here's how it begins.
Winesap was carefully positioned between blowout expensive and pleasantly upscale. In choosing the location, Leo had ensured that no strip malls were nearby, for example. Because it was awful, walking into a mall and dropping $200 on lamb shank and Barolo in the shadow of a Radio Shack. When the restaurant was about 3 years old, Leo had told the chef, Kenneth, to start making his own pasta. And 2 weeks later, Britt entered the kitchen to find two women, one ancient and one about 40. Set up near the walk-in, chatting in Italian and rolling satiny yellow sheets to be cut into tagliatelle. Weeknight sales rose accordingly.
Michelle, tell me about the restaurant at the heart of your book. Well, there are two, but tell us about the first restaurant that we meet, Winesap.
Yes. Well, at this point, Winesap is about 10 years old, and it's run by the two brothers, Britt and Leo. And they were pioneers, but now they've perhaps gotten just a little bit unfocused and maybe just a little bit complacent.
And along comes their younger brother,
yes.
Harry, the black sheep of the family.
Yes. Harry is the one who has been off collecting many more college degrees than most people need, as the book says. So when he appears and says, listen, I'm opening my own restaurant, they are not really interested in helping him out or partnering with him.
Well, it's primarily a story of these rich relationships between the three brothers. But one of the pleasures of reading Bread and Butter is vicariously enjoying all of the food. I was curious about what kind of research you did. Did you just immerse yourself in food? Did you go back and forth between stove and computer all the time?
You know, I drew a lot on just memorable meals that I had had, and then I often just sort of let my imagination do it. So, you know, there are some dishes that I don't know if they would even work. I mean,
really?
I suppose
like
if I
what?
Gave them, well, there's one where there is like a kaffir lime leaf powder, and it's used in a Napoleon with, I think, coconut milk. And I have never talked to a chef and found out if this is even remotely possible. It may not be. And I've been waiting for somebody to be like, that can't happen.
It sounds wonderful.
Well, I think, you know, people can do so much. I'm sure somebody somewhere can do that. Harry left the lamb's neck on the menu, but he could not stop tweaking it. He tried it with artichokes, with toasts and little coins of new potato. He tried it with no starch at all, just carrot and parsley. He tried skewing it sweet tart with gooseberries and skewing it savory and dark with thyme and garlic and braised cipollini onions. Nothing revealed itself to Harry as the obvious course of action. He liked the dish no matter what. He would eat it no matter what. And he knew that this was a problem. A chef should be able to break down a dish to its components in a few bites, not view it as a mere lump of tastiness that had just appeared on a plate. The more Harry tried to fix it, the more confused he became.
Wow, break down a dish into its components. It sounds like architecture.
Yeah, or just like, you know, you teach students how to read like writers, and instead of it just being like, ah, there was one full experience, you know, you have to be able to decide how did the writer get that experience, and a chef can do the same. How did the chef make this, you know, have the effect that it has?
Are you the kind of person who reads cookbooks for fun?
Oh, I am. I get a lot from the library, and then I just sit there and page through them because a little pop in my brain happens when I see a food word. If I see the word like cream, or if I see, I don't know, like the name of a wine, I just am like, oh, it makes me happy. And I think a lot of people are like that. There is something immediately sensual about it and something pleasurable. You know, I mean, we need food. It's pretty obviously deep in our brains that we're going to respond well to that. So for the vast majority of us, I think it's just a sensual pleasure that makes us happy, even just to have it floating in the background. The first desserts were now moving past him, and Britt raised his eyebrows at a server to signal her to slow down and let him look at the plates. The beignet, a generous little pile of sugared pastry next to their glass cup of basil cream. The pears all plump, feminine roundness beneath a veil of warmed dulce de leche. He watched Joshua serve a table of four, placing a dish at an empty seat whose occupant had gone to the restroom. Britt sighed. When Joshua saw Britt watching, he reddened and sidled over to him. "She keeps leaving," he muttered under the din. "Is she feeding a freaking pet back there or what?"
Your characters are not only chefs, they're also restaurateurs. They work the front of the house, they hire and fire staff, they pay incredibly minute attention, not just to the food, but to the entire dining experience in their restaurants. And I have to say, that was kind of a revelation to me.
That was, I think, a big reason why I wanted to write about it, because that's been a really interesting part of this whole restaurant revolution that's happened in the U.S. in the last several years, which is that you can go out for a dinner at a place where you're not going to spend $300 a person, but the same kind of attention has still gone into creating a certain kind of theater, you know, because now people very specifically are trying to show you who they are by how the waitstaff looks or exactly, you know, what they're saying on the menu and that kind of thing. And it's all of this sort of shorthand, and it's a kind of theater, and we just accept it because we've learned this language without even intending to.
So what for you goes into outstanding service? I mean, what annoys you if you go out?
Oh, yes, I have many things. The things that annoy me are if I ask a waiter or waitress what's good or what's especially interesting, what I'm asking is, you know this kitchen, or you should. I expect for you to say everything is great, but I want to know what is especially well done. And I absolutely cannot stand it when the server says, "Oh, well, that depends on what you're in the mood for." I was just like, yes, I'm aware I have tastes and they might not be the same as yours, but this is why you're here.
As a restaurant diner reading your book, I find it kind of alarming how much your characters know about the patrons at the restaurants. I mean, how much can you really tell about, say, a party at a table after just one night?
You know, I do think you can see things. I wrote an essay about this one time about a couple on a first date when I was waiting tables. And it was a terribly awkward date. Or maybe it was just a last date. I don't know. I said first date because it felt to me like a blind date that wasn't going very well. It was just silence at the table and they didn't seem to be enjoying the food. And then the woman got up to go to the restroom before the main course and she never came back. And yet I have to admit, I wasn't surprised. I was shocked because I never thought anyone actually did that in real life. But, you know, you could just feel you can read a table very quickly and you can sort of see how people are behaving with one another. And it's a really fascinating sort of human experiment.
Well, it's great training for a novelist.
Exactly. Which is good because most of us wait tables at some point. And perhaps will again. You never know.
Michelle Wilgen's novel Bread and Butter is just out in paper. The film adaptation of her novel You're Not You, starring Hilary Swank, opens this weekend. Michelle will be back a little later in the hour talking with one of her real-life culinary heroes, Alice Waters, the founder of Chez Panisse, the restaurant that launched a revolution in American eating. But first, another new novel takes us inside the food industry in a very different way. Sweetness Number 9 is a darkly comic debut novel from Stephen Eric Clark. It's the story of a young man who lands his dream job as a chemist in the secretive world of an industrial flavor manufacturer. Doug Gordon asked Stephen Clark for a taste of the book.
To produce a truly remarkable flavor, you had to know what a sample's subtlest notes were comprised of. And this is, in many ways, a godly task. Consider the humble pot roast. It is a sublime creation rising up from more than 600 different flavor molecules, and that's before it's served alongside a dollop of garlic mashed potatoes and a pile of pork fat green beans. With such vast resources and so many privately held compounds, Goldstein, Olivetti, and Dark boasted a veritable book of life. Call it youthful exuberance if you must, but I wanted to taste the sweetness that had been sequestered for so long in nature and now called Jupiter Park home.
Stefan, what inspired you to write a novel set in the world of the flavor science industry?
Well, I had never really thought about flavorings until I read Fast Food Nation. The chapter on food product design really opened my eyes. I'd never really stopped to consider that one word in the list of ingredients, flavor. When I did, it's like whenever you learn a new word, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I started to ask myself, what does this mean? You know, if I'm eating these microwave dinners that have flavorings added to them, am I eating an herb roasted chicken, or am I just eating the idea of an herb roasted chicken?
I think another thing that's interesting about your novel is that it's the first novel to be set in the flavor science industry, isn't it?
It is. I'd certainly never read a novel that was set in this industry. And whenever I knew that, I sort of felt, oh, God, I've got to get this thing done so that nobody beats me to the punch, because it offered so many ways into talking about American culture that I hadn't seen before. Food connects to the military, connects to changes in the American supermarket and the changes to our agricultural policies, most importantly, changes to our family life. How we eat changes how we interact with other people. So once I saw that I could do all of this and use a whole new metaphor system that I hadn't seen in fiction before, I got very excited.
Your novel starts in 1973 and ends 39 years later in 2012, if I'm not mistaken. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why did you want to explore this time frame?
Well, and there are three time periods, really, because I do go back to the war years in Europe. I wanted to make the World War II the baseline because so much of our agricultural policies changed. You know, through the military, we developed these chemicals, which first started off as bombs and became later the pesticides we use in our fields to grow our food. And so I wanted to start there in that sort of era of Tang and then move forward to the late 90s, where the next block of action really takes place when people were starting to question it. This morning, I had reached into the deep freeze for a breakfast sandwich that I'd selected on a recent ramble through my local Acme. Sold as the manwich, this heat-and-serve meal weighed in at a hearty 790 calories. It was comprised of one sausage patty, two eggs, a couple of slices of bacon, and a roof of American cheese as orange as a road cone. I was not eating it out of idle curiosity or owing to an extravagant appetite. It was my routine on Mondays to sit down to a long working breakfast. So in addition to my knife and fork, I had a legal pad and a pencil beside my plate, along with plans to break down and identify all the components of the flavors I could detect in the manwich. Usually, all of this would have given me no small amount of pleasure, but this morning I set my pencil down after scribbling only the most rudimentary of notes, and reached for my stomach, feeling the first pangs of gastrointestinal distress, if not the deft acceleration of things to come.
Tell me about your protagonist, David Levereaux. Who is he?
Well, David Levereaux is a Nixon man at the start, and he campaigns for Nixon, and he wants to just find a company that he can settle into and develop a career, develop a family, and have the life that America promises us. He starts to experience some doubts, though, when he does test sweetness number 9 prior to its bid for FDA approval, and he notices the side effects it causes in the lab rats and the monkeys that he's been given the task of testing. He wants to do the right thing, but at the same time, he's worried about jeopardizing his career, and so instead of being a whistleblower, he swallows his whistle and wakes up 20-some years later with a family and the good life, only to question it again when his family members start to show all of the same symptoms that the lab rats and monkeys once exhibited. And so his evolution in many ways charts the evolution of America at that time, sort of growing into more and more doubts and less trust of the federal government, sort of a Watergate story in many ways.
Yeah, and you mentioned the symptoms that his family experience as the years pass, as sweetness number 9 becomes America's most popular sweetener. What's going on with the family?
Well, the wife is struggling with her weight and has tried everything from the Scarsdale diet to Jane Fonda. And the daughter is suffering from what I call a generalized dissatisfaction with life. David is anxious about all of this. And his young son, who's about 10 years old, Ernest, is showing signs of what could be selective mutism, something that also came out in the monkeys that he once studied. They stopped shrieking as much. Ernest, his son, stops using verbs in his speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and David, I have to say he's a very engaging and very funny protagonist. And much of that humor comes from the way he looks at the world through the lenses of food and flavor. I'm thinking in particular about that great passage where he's thinking about his son Ernest, where you write, "Churchill once spoke of Russia as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. If I were to speak of Ernest in a similar way, I might describe him as a corn dog wrapped in a slice of pizza stuffed inside a Hot Pocket." I love those sentences. That's great. And it leads me to think about the connection between food and humor. Why do you think food is funny?
I don't know. The thing that makes me interested about food is that it's something that we can all relate to. In the book, I talk about the supermarket being the one place that we all still mingle. In a way, it's the church, you know, the place where we all still congregate. So food is something that everyone has a connection to, and it can show how we all react to food differently, how we all gather into certain tribes along what foods we eat. And that was what interested me about the possibilities in this book.
There's one particular detail in Sweetness Number 9 I'm curious about. David's parents were killed by Charles Whitman, the engineering student and former U.S. Marine who killed 16 people and wounded 32 others in the shooting spree at the Tower of the University of Texas in Austin on August 1st of 1966. Why did you want to make David's parents die at the hands of Charles Whitman?
Yeah, that's a good question. To me, this was when the age of anxiety really started. Before that, there was the assassination of Kennedy, but with the shooting at the clock tower in Texas, all of a sudden the public space didn't feel so safe anymore. Of course, that was amplified, you know, thousands of times on 9/11, but this was the time when life in America became a little bit more anxious, and I see that anxiety in how we interact with food. Is it safe for us? I won't eat that. I'm sure it's not good for you. GMO, no GMO. We all have our anxieties, and so charting anxiety in the 20th century for me started with that moment at Charles Whitman, and so therefore David's parents had to visit there.
And your next novel, you're working on a new novel. Can you, without spoiling too much, give us a little synopsis of what that's going to be about?
Yeah, American Gulag is going to imagine a Russian-style revolution in the United States following the collapse of the U.S. dollar. All those people who were too big to fail back after the economic collapse will no longer be too big to fail. They'll be put on the first train out of town and be sent off to all of these prisons. The largest among them will be at the former Mall of America in Minneapolis.
Perfect. Beautiful.
Bloomington, I should say.
I hope we don't have to wait 13 years to read American Gulag.
Yeah, I'm hoping it'll be a slender book. After 13 years, I want to get one out in the next year or two.
We'll look forward to it. Thank you so much, Stefan.
Thank you, Don.
Stefan Eric Clark's novel is Sweetness Number 9. Doug Gordon talked with him. We're talking about books and cooks in this hour. We've heard from writers. When we come back, we'll talk with chefs about food and writing. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now from Portland, Oregon, it's the pie poet, Kate Lebo. She's the founder of a roving pastry academy and writer studio called The Pie School, and author of A Commonplace Book of Pie, poetry for the cookbook section.
Pie as a form is this thing that conceals what's inside it. You've got pastry wrapping something that's inside it. So it's a secret. Pie is best handmade in small batches. And when I say handmade, I mean your hands in the dough. That is how you mix it. That is the best way. Right now, I'm obsessed with Shaker lemon pie. You cut up the lemons very thin, macerate them in sugar overnight. Whip them up with some eggs and just do it in a double crust. It's tart, it's sweet, it's really intense. Some of the best recipes that I've found have come from farm cookbooks, like the Farm Journal 1965 is one of my favorites. The thing about this book that I wrote, The Commonplace Book of Pie, is that it's this mashup of a bunch of different genres of writing to create personas, these imagined personas behind different pies. I'm going to read you chocolate cream pie. How does that sound? People who love chocolate cream pie move through this world in a swarm of music. Their cars leak bass lines. Their exhaust sings from the dark of the pipe. Periodically, they experiment with the softness of their genders and find them lacking every time. Wear skirts to feel the hair on their thighs and pants to bind their bodies into the clean lines of a park bench. They invite you to sit down. The chocolate pie lover would like to convince you that her height is 3 inches above the crown of her head. She isn't lying, exactly. She's creating the truth, believer by believer, just as you would if you too had a voice as big as a church. So pie is a creative practice that grounds me in these very humble materials and grounds me in a generous act because I can't eat that pie all myself. I have to give it to someone. What I do is I find a restaurant or a bar or a home or some other fun venue, and I bake up as much pie as I can, and I set them up on a table, and I invite everyone I know, and I tell them to invite everyone they know, and everyone comes over, and we have pie. Sometimes I sell it, sometimes I give it away. It just kind of depends. And the idea is to use pie as this catalyst for conversations across communities. So by inviting everyone I know and them inviting everyone they know, it's like, in some ways, it's like Facebook in person. Pie makes it easy to be together.
Kate Lebo is an award-winning poet and baker. She's just published her first cookbook called Pie School: Lessons in Fruit, Flour, and Butter. Earlier this hour, novelist Michelle Wilgin looked back at the restaurant revolution of the 70s and 80s, the movement that created a new food language in America, centered on fresh, seasonal, local ingredients. One of the pioneers of that movement was Alice Waters, the founder of the legendary Berkeley, California restaurant Chez Panisse. Her passion today is educating the next generation in the principles of slow food living through her Edible Schoolyard project. We were curious to know what a novelist and a chef would talk about, so we got Michelle Wilgin and Alice Waters together for a conversation.
I was gratified to see, when I was thinking about you as an educator, to see that you had been a Montessori teacher, which just seems so right. And I was curious if the Montessori ideas still linger in your life, in your teaching, in its relationship to cooking.
Completely. I think I'm a Montessorian through and through. I didn't realize it when I left teaching and opened Chez Panisse, but I have been really influenced by her philosophy of teaching the whole child, you know, to the ideas of the education of the senses, that these are our pathways into our mind. Mm-hmm. And if they haven't been fine-tuned, we're only getting the sort of most elementary information into our heads. And when we become so sedentary and we aren't really smelling food, because we're not cooking food and we're not touching it, really. We're just opening the package and we're seeing things wrapped up and we want everything sanitary. And all of these things prevent us from that vital experience of discernment around smelling, around tasting, around seeing, around hearing.
I would love to hear a little bit more about your experiences with the Edible Schoolyard. I have to guess that perhaps you went into it with fairly clear ideas about children and eating and what they like and what they don't or what would interest them most. What do you think are the biggest satisfactions and challenges for you in that educator role?
Well, the greatest satisfaction is that it really works. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really works. I thought of the whole thing right away. I thought the garden should be the center of the school. The cafeteria should be a place of real learning, that the garden and the kitchen were not gardens and kitchens per se. They were labs for math and science and art and dramatic arts with the improvisational cooking in the kitchen. And so I saw it in this very big way So when I go to see the school now, and it's almost 20 years later, when I walk into that kitchen classroom and the kids are sitting around the table and they're having these most amazing conversations about, it's an English class, and they were trying to think of all the new words that they've learned from doing the cooking, like julienne and mirepoix and caramelization and slow roasting. And, I mean, I was just delighted to hear this and to know that it's going down very deep. Mm-hmm. These were eighth graders, and they were having a conversation that could have been had in the kitchen of Chez Panisse. Mm.
I love, though, that you're talking about the democratization of this, because I was also really interested in thinking about activism. And I'd come across that quote from Mario Salvio that was in 40 Years of Chez Panisse, which was that America is becoming ever more the utopia of sterilized and automated contentment. And you had talked about reaching for a different kind of contentment, maybe something that was a little bit more authentic or rough-hewn and more holistic, as we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But I was interested in thinking about that because, really, you know, activism is usually fed by a certain kind of discontent. And I just thought it was interesting that your activism was the search for contentment, and yet there's always that seed that comes from, you know, discontent with this current status quo.
Well, it certainly empowers it. Mm-hmm. I really was educated during the free speech movement in Berkeley, and so I believed that we could change the world. Mm-hmm. And when we stopped the war in Vietnam, I just thought, we can do anything. You know, and it's why I had the naivete to think I can run a restaurant and people mm-hmm. are going to come. If I serve really good food, mm-hmm. they're going to be there. And in fact, when that started to happen, it just kept me going. Mm-hmm. And it was so positive. It wasn't against something. It was trying to win people over by feeding them something delicious and waking up their senses. And then they changed the way they wanted to live their lives. And I'm still in that place.
I think about that because, you know, there's the whole question of making this good food available to everybody and how difficult that can be to make that happen. And I often think about the same idea in terms of writing or literature, that we both sort of, you know, we exalt and devalue things like art and cooking at the same time. You know, we both say, well, cooking is a great thing, but then we look for all these other ways to avoid making sure that we protect our resources or that we can get good things to people. And, you know, the things that linger from one culture to another tend to be our art or our architecture. But then at the same time, somebody tries to make a living as an artist and it's almost impossible.
We have been deeply indoctrinated by a fast food culture. It's not just the food. It's the whole culture that's grown up around the values that are learned from the eating of fast food. We want our whole world to be fast, cheap, and easy. It's very destructive what's gone on since Mario Savio was talking about it in the 60s, because we are really being manipulated in a way that has made us sick and addicted. And I think the only way out of that is, you know, with a delicious revolution.
You know, what's funny is that I think the one part of it that doesn't seem like it's often been part of American culture is the whole centerpiece of what you were describing, which is the idea of pleasure. You know, there's the old Puritan idea. We want individuality and hard work and all these things, but we forget about pleasure. So no wonder we need a reminder.
Absolutely. But, I mean, these are values that have been really with us since the beginning of time. I was lucky that I discovered them when I went to France when I was 19. And that culture was a kind of slow food culture. They had 2 hours for a school lunch. They went to the farmer's market twice a day. I think these ideas are so enticing. I would say that when you're living in a fast food culture that is always trying to cut off, deaden the conversation with music, or just feeding you so many French fries that you can't think anymore, or, you know, it's just a whole other way. And people are wanting the interconnection. I think they're wanting real food.
Michelle Wilgen talking with Alice Waters, the chef, author, and owner of Chez Panisse Restaurant in Berkeley, California. She's one of the best-known food activists in the world and creator of the Edible Schoolyard Project. So the latest California food sensation is not a restaurant, it's a blog. Thug Kitchen is a profanity-laced vegan food blog that racked up 500,000 Facebook followers and praise from celebrities like Gwyneth Paltrow and Rachel Ray. The anonymous authors have just come out with a cookbook, and their secret is out. Thug Kitchen is a white couple from Hollywood. Now Michelle Davis and Matt Holloway are fielding questions about the racial politics of their food vocabulary. Charles Monroe Kane caught up with them to talk about how we talk about food.
Michelle, I wonder if you, do you have the book in front of you?
Yeah, I do.
Could you read the opening of your book, like the first column? Would you mind starting there?
No, I don't mind at all.
It's exhilarating. It's like waiting in class to be called on, and you get called on, and you're like, oh, yes, my section has a swear word in it.
Welcome to Thug Kitchen, bitches. We're here to help. Our motto is simple. Eat like you give a f***. There is an aura of an elitism surrounding healthy eating, and so many people tend to associate health with wealth. We couldn't identify with these beautiful bloggers and their big-ass kitchens, waxing poetic about fennel pollen. We live in the real world.
I remember the first time I saw it on Facebook, I'm like, what the hell is this? Your language is so stirring and so vulgar. Why the vulgar language?
You know, it makes us laugh. Vegans have this reputation, some well-earned, for being fussy and self-righteous. We don't want to be like that. We want to show people that just to, you know, if you want to be vegan or you just want to eat more vegetables, you don't have to change who you are. You can still be a normal person.
Quick reminder and aside here, we're going to try not to swear in this
Sorry,
interview.
That's right.
I told you guys, you guys got all excited.
No problem.
Speaking of the recipes, can we go through one? I think if our listeners understand what you're doing, kind of the edge. Could you go through the beer and cauliflower recipe?
Yeah. Sure.
Which I'll do full disclosure, I cooked for 16 people recently and it was delicious.
So it's the roasted beer and lime cauliflower tacos with cilantro coleslaw. Pretty simple. You just chop the cauliflower into small florets, no bigger than a quarter. In a saucepan, you warm the beer, broth, lime juice, soy sauce, hot sauce, and garlic over medium heat. Add the cauliflower and simmer for about a minute and a half. Drain. You toss the spices, salt, and olive oil together in a large bowl. Add the cauliflower and onion. Dump it on a baking sheet and bake till brown, stirring halfway about 20 minutes.
In a carne asada world with tacos, do you really think people are going to eat cauliflower tacos?
Yeah.
Yeah, cauliflower is cheaper than carne asada.
After they try them, they will.
So are you in the kitchen? You're by yourself? You got some tunes on and you're like, okay, yeah, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try that. What am I going to do?
We probably had NPR on.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, shoot, Matt.
You know, I've talked to so many people that I was going to be interviewing you today and they're like, oh, I love their blog. I love their website. Were you expecting to have such popularity?
No, there's no way. I mean, when we created it, it was like a free Tumblr account. There was no way that we could have anticipated the traffic that it has received.
Yeah, and we did it to make each other laugh. And we're happy other people, you know, latched onto it. But there's no way.
Tell me a bit more about yourself. So let's start with you, Matt. How did you get here? Like, who are you? I know you had some day, like, what was your day job?
You know, I worked in a mailroom. I was a production assistant, and it sucked. Fetching coffee and lunches for people, and I hated it.
Professionally, I worked in a grocery store on the floor of a grocery store for about 8 years. So I really got to see how regular people struggle with adopting a healthier lifestyle.
So you're saying that it's off-putting for you, these elites and more complicated vegan recipes and blogs and cookbooks. What is it about it that's off-putting for you?
You know, I'll say me going from a diet that was mostly Mountain Dew and frozen pizza to a vegetarian diet to now I'm on a vegan diet is a lot of it just, it's kind of condescending and it's really alienating. There's a lot of the author's personality that comes out in it and, you know, they wax poetic And it's just, if for somebody who's new to that world, it's like, oh, I don't have your big kitchen. I don't have, you know, all these tools, and I don't have all these ingredients. And I immediately give up.
Yeah, some of these authors don't realize that not everyone has access to outdoor space to grow their own herbs and vegetables. You know, not everybody can spend 6 hours going to 12 different farmers markets. And so it's really easy to tune out when the author's experiences that they're sharing as universal don't reflect yours.
I could see very easily you're two young white folks from a city that this could be completely put in the category of hipster. Are you guys hipsters?
I think probably the first rule of being a hipster is denying you're a hipster.
Yes,
but,
you have to deny.
But no, I mean, we don't wear a lot of plaid or suspenders or anything like that.
Yeah, I don't have a record player. I don't collect vinyl.
Yeah, we're not cooking ironically.
You know, it's interesting, though, for me, when I go back to language, you know, mm-hmm. for my generation, and I'm in my mid-40s, the word thug is synonymous with black or Latino gangs. And I think, you know, think Tupac Shakur's Thug Life, you know, tattooed across his stomach. Mm-hmm. You are not black or Latino. What makes you a thug?
We think of it more as an attitude. And have, you know, we understand that thug is a loaded word and has definitely only gotten more loaded in the past year and a half. But, you know, for us, it's always been about the attitude. The site is about being like a badass in the kitchen. And, you know, we joke that we're verbally abusing people into eating some more goddamn vegetables. So that's really the point.
I don't see that the word thug being synonymous with, you know, any particular person. It's just the personality. It's like it's an aggression, you know.
Michelle Davis and Matt Holloway are the authors of Thug Kitchen, a blog and now a cookbook. Charles Monroe Kane talked with them. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name's John Ronson. I'm the author of The Many Stoic Goats and Lost at Sea and Frank and The Psychopath Test. And my dangerous idea is, do psychopaths rule the world? And actually, it's not my idea. It's an idea shared by leading psychologists and psychiatrists across the world. They all said the same thing to me, that psychopathy is such a powerful brain anomaly that it's remoulded society all wrong, because capitalism at its most remorseless rewards psychopathic character traits. If you look at the psychopath checklist designed by a man called Robert Hare, the items on the checklist are items that don't only identify psychopaths, but identify successful business people. So there's lack of remorse, lack of empathy, cunning manipulative, grandiose sense of self-worth, glibness, superficial charm. These things propel you to the top. And according to Hare, 1% of the general public is a psychopath, but that rises to 4%. Of CEOs and business leaders. And the brain anomaly is so powerful that it spreads way beyond the 4%. The ripples go everywhere. They go throughout the business. And then the business competitors have to act more psychopathically to keep up. When I was writing my book, The Psychopath Test, I started writing to famously ruthless business people. I wrote to Bernie Madoff and I said, can I come and interview you in prison to find out if you're a psychopath? And he didn't write back. So then I wrote to Chainsaw Al Dunlap, the famous asset stripper from the 90s, who would go into a failing business and shut down 30% of the workforce and turn towns into ghost towns across the American South. I went to see him and I convinced him to let me go through the psychopath checklist with him. So item one was grandiose sense of self-worth, which would have been hard for him to deny because he was standing underneath a giant oil painting of himself. His house was filled with oil paintings of him and his wife, Judy, and his German shepherd dogs. And he said, well, you got to believe in you. So he said yes to a great many of the traits on the checklist. But I would say this. It's a very compelling theory that psychopaths rule the world. However, the day that I was with Al Dunlap, every time he said something to me that wasn't psychopathic, I thought, well, I won't put that in my book. So he said no to juvenile delinquency. He said he got accepted into West Point and they don't let delinquents in West Point. I thought, well, that's fine. I won't put that in my book. And I realized actually that becoming this seasoned psychopath spotter had turned me a little bit psychopathic, and that I was desperate to label him, desperate to reduce him to these diagnostic labels. And I realized that not only do psychopaths rule the world, but it's kind of psychopathic to start reducing everybody to some medical diagnosis.
That's John Ronson's dangerous idea. He's the author of The Psychopath Test. For more dangerous ideas, check our website, ttbook.org. On our minds this week, maybe you saw the recent news that a computer passed the famous Turing test for the first time. That's the test to see if a computer can trick people into thinking they're talking with another person. There's actually some debate about whether the computer known as Eugene really did pass the Turing test, but there's no doubt the clever quotient for computers is ramping up. Are they actually smarter than we are? And are they changing the way we think? Journalist Clive Thompson tracks new technology as a columnist for Wired magazine, and his book, Smarter Than You Think, is just out in paper. Steve Paulson caught up with him.
Clive, you start your book with the question, who's better at chess, computers or humans? And I think most of us thought that we knew the answer. It was computers ever since the IBM computer Deep Blue beat the world champion Garry Kasparov back in 1997. But you have a more complicated answer than that. Why are you interested in this question?
Well, the reason why I like the story of computer chess is because I found it was sort of a great metaphor for what's happening to our relationship to technology in everyday life. Because, as you know, right after Deep Blue beat Kasparov, everyone thought, okay, that's it. Chess is over. Let's just fold up and go home. Because a computer is not playing chess the way that a human does. Kasparov is sitting there and he's trying to sort of pull his decades of intuition to think of the best move. But Deep Blue was just doing this very straightforward brute force attack. You know, figure the best move, 8 moves out, pick that, recalculate over and over again. And, you know, Kasparov knew eventually he was going to lose to something like that because human intelligence doesn't work that way.
We just don't have the calculating power.
Yes, exactly. So Kasparov had a much more interesting reaction that very few people know about. What he did is he said, well, let's take a look at the fact that computers think, quote unquote, think in a different way from humans. Maybe we can do something fun with this. Instead of having them fight each other, why don't we have them collaborate? And so he invented advanced chess, where a grandmaster would sit down with a laptop and face off against another grandmaster with a laptop. And they were allowed to use it as they wanted. They would program the chess pieces into the computer, see what the software recommended, consult databases of older games. And it was fast chess, 60-minute chess, you know, speed chess. So they couldn't sit there forever. And what happened was that the chess became explosively creative because they suddenly freed to do things they would never have dared to do otherwise.
And so you're saying that humans with the computers together could beat a really good computer. I mean, so the humans still had something to add to this.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. In fact, the really crazy thing was that it turned out that you didn't have to be a grandmaster to excel at this type of chess. You could be just a kind of a really good amateur. They had one competition where a couple of New England relative amateurs beat everyone, and they in fact played against a supercomputer that was playing on its own that was stronger than Deep Blue. So basically, these two kids played chess better than Kasparov played against Deep Blue.
So why? I mean, what is it that humans can bring to the game of chess that a computer itself can't do?
Intuition. It turned out the best teams were the ones that understood when to ignore what the computer was suggesting because they could do something that would freak out the human across the table, right? And that's how they got so good at it.
Now, I know that you're interested in this chess example, not just because you're a chess fan, but this is a kind of metaphor for how you see technology generally. I mean, it sounds like you're saying it's not that technology is going to displace humans, but if humans can use technology in the right way, the sky's the limit.
Absolutely, yeah. You said something quite key there, which is if they can learn how to use it. I mean, you're not just going to necessarily become smarter because you've got a smartphone in your pocket. You have to learn how to use it well. And this is a challenge that we faced over and over and over again. You know, like libraries came along and it wasn't intuitive at all exactly how they should be set up. It took us a couple hundred years to get the Dewey Decimal System in place, you know, to organize a library. Before then, they were just a jumble and students would show up and they could not get anything out of it. So we're in the process now where we have these unbelievable tools for thought and we're beginning to realize we have to grapple with learning how to use them.
But, you know, there is now a kind of cottage industry of books coming out saying, watch out for all this new technology. And the people who write these are not dumb about technology. I mean, Nicholas Carr said that we're losing the ability to read and think deeply. Jaron Lanier says that technology is on the verge of displacing the middle class. There are lots of other people who say that we're becoming so dependent on technology that computer algorithms are going to dictate what we do, you know, what we buy, the news we consume, what entertainment we seek out. I take it that you don't think much about these complaints.
Well, you know, some of them I agree with. Nick Carr did an enormous service to the world by decisively dismantling and attacking the idea that multitasking is a good thing, right? There was this idea that, you know, if you had 17 windows open on your computer, you were somehow operating at peak intellectual efficiency. There was something sort of glorious about that. But what he demonstrated, and which is absolutely true, is that no, if you're being constantly interrupted and trying to do 40 things at once, you will do none of it well.
If you keep checking your email every 10 minutes, you're just not going to get anything done.
If you're flipping to Facebook and then going back to the report on Twitter, it's disastrous for the attention span.
So just to follow up on that point, attention span, how do you deal with that in your own life?
Oh,
I mean,
because
you have all these gadgets at your fingertips. So what do you do?
Well, I do a couple things. One is that I do email in bursts. I don't keep it open all day long. I pick a couple times a day to go through it because if you just sit there, it'll ding every 30 seconds and you will always stop and go what you're doing. Same type of thing with Twitter or Facebook. I don't leave them open all the time in the background. And then on the weekends, I just go pretty much entirely offline. I stop checking my email on Friday night and I don't check it again until, you know, Monday morning. Because there are types of thinking, creative thinking that only come when you're on that long walk after having spent 4 hours reading a deep book. The thing that I disagree with Carr and other people is that they will say, no, your brain is permanently damaged and you cannot find a balance. I don't think that's true.
Now, one thing that you talk about in your book is what you call ambient awareness. What do you mean by that?
Ambient awareness is a really interesting concept. What starts happening when we begin using this very short-form media, like these sort of seemingly silly little utterances, you know, each tweet, each Instagram update, each Snapchat, each Facebook status update, they all seem so small on their own. And anytime a social critic wants to say, you know, Western society's decline is here, they will find an individual tweet and say, you know, look.
And there's plenty of evidence.
Exactly. Look at this dumb tweet. You know, I've written them myself. But the point about these media is that they gain enormous power in the aggregate. If you talk to anyone for their first week on Twitter, they'll be like, the first day is like, why am I doing this? This is silly. After about a week, they're like, I see, yeah, this person, you know, talks about this a lot. That's kind of interesting. This person does these pictures. Kind of interesting. Then after a year, they've been following these people. They have this unbelievably ESP-like glimpse into what this person has been thinking about, what they've been worrying about. And that connection is fantastic because it allows you to understand the internal and intellectual lives of other people in such a way that it enhances when you meet them face to face. It gives you more access to, oh, I think I know who could answer this for me. It lets you see and encounter in a serendipitous way pieces of knowledge that you would never have seen on your own. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the most interesting and most, I think, ill understood aspects of modern short-form media. We're accustomed to assessing utterances, particularly written utterances, we're accustomed to assessing them at the level of the individual utterances. We're not accustomed to assessing them in aggregate.
Hmm. We should talk some about what all this means for education, because as we know, more and more schools are trying to get computers into every classroom, iPads to every student if money is available. Is this a good thing?
I'm torn. I visited a lot of schools where I saw a lot of money blown on technology that did not seem to be having any impact on learning at all. So, you know, you have all these, you know, whiteboards that are $12,000 that are really no significant improvement over a chalkboard. You have people using iPads to do, you know, finger painting when it strikes me that, you know, $1 finger paints, you know,
right,
actually do that probably better, you know, because they get into the tactile stuff. So what I learned from talking to the teachers, and they all told me that there were amazing things they'd done, and they all basically were pretty much free. It was all like simple stuff, like How do you get your kids to read and write more? Well, get them to read and then blog about it in front of the public, the whole world. Hmm. And when it goes before the whole world, oh my goodness, they panic and they work harder and they write longer because they're willing to sort of phone it in for the teacher because who really cares? It's just a teacher. But if it's going to go in front of the world and their friends and their parents, they suddenly freak out. They're writing 40% longer. They're writing more lexically complicated. They're doing
if their friends are actually going to check what they wrote that's online.
Oh, it's not even friends. Actually, it's strangers. I mean, this is the thing. Like, you'd get people, this one school that did this in New Zealand actively sent out notes saying, all right, parents and relatives all around the world, we want you to check and comment on this stuff. So they're getting comments from Germany, New York, and stuff like that. And they were enthralled. And they had never written so much or so well in their lives.
So you're saying you still need teachers. It's just that teachers can, with these tools, can be more effective.
In fact, actually, you not only need teachers, you need teachers who are going to work harder than ever before. Because it's very easy to sit in front of a class and give the same lecture to everyone and lose 50% of them. It's very hard to customize your learning to 20 or 30 kids in your class. So these teachers I talked to, they were knocking themselves out. I think they should all be given raises, if you ask me. And I specifically went to schools that were not in wealthy areas, some that actually had really troubled kids from ESL backgrounds, and they were doubling their scores over a period of a few months because of the amount of one-on-one they were able to get in math. I mean, this is stuff I'd never seen anywhere before. So yeah, when teachers get it and they understand how to use it, they can do it for cheap and for free, and they can have fantastic results.
Clive Thompson is a columnist for Wired Magazine and author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. He spoke with Steve Paulson. This hour is over, but there's more online. Books, links, music listings, and lots of other interviews. You'll find it all at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison by Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.